In 2008, 2.5 years after Maria Bruno was stabbed to death in El Monte, California, investigators were no closer to solving the murder. Michael Gargiulo was now living with his wife in Santa Monica, California. He was a free man after being connected to 3 separate murders between 1993 and 2005. Just across the alleyway from his apartment, 26-year-old Michelle Murphy lived in a second-floor apartment at 1229 12th Street. Murphy was petite, standing 5'1", but she was athletic, worked out regularly, and would often jump rope and sprint in the alley behind her apartment. She had a roommate, but on the night of April 20th, 2008, her roommate was out of the country. After getting home from work, Murphy finished doing laundry and went to sleep around 8 p.m. It was a warm night, so Michelle left the window open. Just before midnight, Michelle woke up with a man on top of her, stabbing her repeatedly in the chest. She tried to protect herself, suffering multiple stab wounds to her arms and her hands as she tried to grab the blade. Michelle kicked and fought, screaming, "Why are you doing this?" And the blood coupled with the struggle made it hard for the attacker to control her. During the frenzy, he somehow managed to cut his own wrist with the knife, giving Murphy the opportunity to pull her legs to her chest and kick the attacker off of her. The man turned to leave, but told Murphy, "I'm sorry," before he fled the scene. Michelle Murphy ran to the door, slammed it, and locked it. She called her boyfriend, Vincent Buono, who called 911.
911 emergency, Calderon.
Hi, my friend in Santa Monica just reported a break-in. She called me, and I want to make sure that she called the police.
Okay, what's the location of the emergency?
It's 1229 12th Street.
1229 12th Street? Okay.
Apartment 10.
Okay, do you have her phone number?
It's in my phone, yeah.
Okay, because I'm gonna have to give her a call, because I'm going to have to speak to her directly.
Okay, let me get out of my phone. Hold on 1 second.
Okay, actually we already have the call. Hang on for just 1 second. Do you know what the circumstances are in regards to it, or? Sir? Do you know what the circumstances are in regards to this?
She told me that she woke up and there was someone on top of her and she forced them off and they ran out.
Okay, we are on our way. Thanks for calling, sir.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
April 28th, 2008. The time, 11:46 p.m.
Hello?
Hi, this is the Santa Monica Police Department. Are you calling from 1229 12th Street?
Yes.
Okay, what is your name?
Michelle.
Michelle, what happened? Where is that person now? How long ago?
Not more than probably 7 or 8 minutes ago. I don't know. I'm weak and I'm...
The fire department is already on the way and we're on our way. What did this person look like?
I only know they were tall and I think they had a hoodie. I just, you know...
Was he white, black, Hispanic, Asian?
I don't know. It was dark.
Do you remember what his clothing was, what he was wearing?
He definitely had on pants and like a long sleeve, like sweatshirt kind of thing.
What, do you remember what color the sweatshirt was?
Everything was dark. No.
Okay, do you remember what color pants?
No.
Okay, did he, besides stabbing you, did he hurt you in any other way?
No.
Okay, the fire department is on our way and we are already there. We're looking for the guy now. We'll be making contact with you in just a second. Do you remember how big this guy was? How tall he was?
He was probably... maybe the most, I don't know, like 5'11 or something.
Thin, medium, or heavy?
Thin.
And do you remember his hair? He broke into your window?
He broke the screen.
Okay. Do you remember his hair color, Michelle?
No, I didn't see any of that.
Do you remember if he was wearing any type of headgear, like a hat or anything like that?
No. I felt it hit his jacket out of his
bullet. Do you remember any scars, marks, or tattoos or anything like that?
No.
Okay. Was he armed with just the knife?
Yeah.
Michelle, I'm sorry. I'm here with you, and can you walk to the door? Are you able to walk to the door?
What?
Are you able to walk to the door, Michelle? Because
yes.
The police are there.
Yes.
We're here with you, okay?
Is that you?
Yes, we're here with you now. So go open the door for me, okay?
Santa Monica Police Department were on the scene shortly. Let's bring in Daryl Lowe, Chief of Police, Redmond Police Department, former lieutenant with the Santa Monica Police Department who investigated the Michelle Murphy attack. Chief Lowe, can you describe the scene at Michelle Murphy's apartment?
Yeah, so by the time I got there, the scene had pretty much been contained by the responding patrol officers. The first patrol officer to arrive on scene arrived and made his way into the apartment, saw the apartment in disarray and indicative of some type of a struggle. He did notice that there was a blood trail leading from the apartment, down the stairs, along the walkway out towards the alley.
When Michelle Murphy was interviewed, did she indicate there might be someone who wanted to hurt her?
No, she seemed just, like your all-American, young adult, carefree, didn't have, enemies or anything like that. So it wasn't, readily apparent, who might be responsible for this, this vicious attack.
How did the attacker gain access to the apartment?
So the first responding officer noticed a footprint on the in the dust on the handrail leading up to Michelle Murphy's apartment. So we were able to conclude that the suspect stood on the handrail, cut the screen, and opened up the window prior to going in and assaulting Ms. Murphy. The investigation also indicated that the suspect pre-staged his getaway by opening the front door. The suspect then went into Michelle Murphy's bedroom, straddled her, and began to stab her, which obviously caused her to wake up, and she put up one hell of a fight. And in that struggle, the suspect cut himself, which led to the blood trail and provided the blood trail that we were ultimately able to use to identify the suspect.
How does the process work for obtaining blood samples?
Yeah, so with the crime scene, it was critically important to limit, ingress and egress. Obviously, we needed to get paramedics in to, provide aid, to the victim. But once she was transported, the scene was locked down, and then our forensic technicians came out and took samples of the blood. Since we did have, blood samples, then it was put into the CODIS database. And with the hopes that we would actually, get a hit and that would help us to identify our suspect, which it ultimately did. So the process is essentially the blood is collected. It's submitted to the LA County Sheriff's Department's crime lab, to their serology unit. They do their scientific work and then they get it. They get that DNA profile uploaded into CODIS, which is the offender database. And it goes through the, hundreds of thousands or millions of records that it has in there. And then lo and behold, it identified our suspect.
It would take another month for the test results to come back. But eventually, Santa Monica police got a match. The blood left at the scene of Michelle Murphy's apartment was Michael Gargiulo. The same DNA that was found under the fingernails of Trisha Boccaccio after she was murdered in 1993. Chief Lowe, what were the next steps of the investigation?
So once we got the CODIS confirmation, we had a named suspect at that point. And then it was through, I'll call it just good old fashioned networking and collaboration, where we spoke with our colleagues, or the lead detective, Rich Lewis, spoke with his fellow detectives, both from the Los Angeles Police Department and then also from the LA County Sheriff's Department. since we at that point knew that they too had had contact with Michael Gargiulo, and we began the process of trying to, you know, to locate him.
On June 6, 2008, Santa Monica police arrested Michael Gargiulo in a Rite Aid parking lot. Chief Lowe, how did the Santa Monica police track Gargiulo down?
So at the point, had put the puzzle pieces together. We knew he was a HVAC handyman. We had got information about the van that he had used. And so we put our surveillance, team on him. They made, I'll say positive confirmation of him. And they waited for, the appropriate opportunity. He happened to pull into a pharmacy parking lot a few blocks away from their apartment. And once he did, the two units basically swooped in. Officers jumped out, identified themselves, and placed him under arrest. When he was arrested, there wasn't a huge fight or struggle. I think he was somewhat, caught by surprise. He did have a background as a boxer and had a previous history of assaults on police officers. But a couple of the officers that were on the unit at that time were, I'll say, formidable in size as well. So I think he thought twice or better of it. Once he was taken into custody, he asked a question that in the law enforcement world we would call indicia of guilt, in the sense of he asked, which agency is this, or what organization, is this about, which suggests that he knew that, he was wanted by multiple law enforcement agencies, which, that obviously has become, clear now that all the dots have been connected.
Can you tell us about the interaction between Gargiulo and Santa Monica police after he was arrested?
Once he was in custody, the lead investigator, attempted to interview him, because at this point we knew we had a serial killer, in custody. We were familiar, we knew about both the LAPD case in Hollywood. We knew about the Sheriff's Department case, and then we know about the original case back in Illinois, where his I'll call it his murder spree, first started. I know that, like I said, the lead investigator did attempt to interview him once we had him in custody for our particular case, but I'm not sure if there were multiple attempts. I know at some point he did kind of change his tune tried to control more of the narrative around, his arrest and his pleas and whatnot, but I couldn't speak, any further detail.
With Gargiulo in custody, Sergeant Rich Lewis of the Santa Monica Police Department then recalled a conversation he had with Detective Mark Lilienfeld about another murder, which Lilienfeld was looking into for a possible connection to Maria Bruno's murder. Let's bring back Mark Lilienfeld, retired L.A. County Sheriff's Detective who investigated Maria Bruno's death. Mark, what did Sergeant Lewis tell you when you spoke again?
Initially, I want to say it was perhaps a year or even several years prior to the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy, Santa Monica Police Department was investigating another murder unrelated of a young woman who was pretty viciously killed inside of her apartment. Her name was Julie Redman, I believe. And there were some similarities to the Julie Redman murder to the Maria Bruno murder. And I wound up contacting Santa Monica Police Department Sergeant Rich Lewis. Rich is really the hero in a lot of this story here for sure. And we kind of compared notes to the two different murders, mine being the murder of Maria Bruno and his being the murder of Julie Redman. And we kind of determined relatively quickly that, in fact, besides they were pretty horrendous murders of young women inside of their homes, there were too many dissimilarities to kind of count them as being related to each other. And really, that was the end of my conversation and my contact with Rich Lewis. Fast forward now to the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy. And Rich, because he's a good policeman, saw similarities between the Michelle Murphy attempted murder and the Maria Bruno murder that had happened earlier in December of 2005. And when Rich started doing a background on Michael Thomas Gargiulo, he realized that he used to live in an address in El Monte. So Rich immediately actually had his partner, Karen Thompson, give me a call. And it turned out that the address in El Monte was the same apartment building where Maria Bruno had been murdered. And in fact, I had attempted to contact Mike Gargiulo like three separate times during a witness canvas of the building's occupants, but had never been able to reach him or to contact him. So Rich really kind of, you know, put two and two together that Mike Gargiulo used to live in the same building where my murder had happened, that had very striking similarities to the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy. So that's really how Rich and I wound up kind of hooking up to work this investigation together. I say that tongue in cheek because, again, Rich really deserves all the kudos and credit for making this thing happen and coming together and identifying Gargiulo as being responsible for the attack on Michelle Murphy.
Did you ever speak to Gargiulo? How close was his apartment to Maria's?
She lived in apartment 20, which was on the ground floor on the north side of the building. And on the south side of the building, on the second story, in a different apartment, was Mike Gargiulo. And I believe it was apartment number 10. And from Gargiulo's apartment, he could easily go to his front window, to his kitchen window, look down. He could see the whole interior courtyard of the building. And he could see, of course, all of the apartments and their front doors and the windows most of the apartments that were in this 80 unit building. I believe there's like 35 or 40 on the ground floor, another 35 or 40 apartments on the second floor. And ringing the second floor was an outdoor, kind of like a catwalk, a balcony. So that's, you'd walk up a flight of stairs to go from ground floor to second floor. So Gargiulo, who turned out to be the suspect in this case, he could look out his kitchen window, his living room window, and look right into Maria's apartment. There was a bit of distance between them. They were separated by this big cement courtyard. There was a barbecue area, kind of like a picnic, table type area. And there was a swimming pool. But he had a clear, unobstructed view. I know at one time we measured it, and it was probably maybe 120, 130 feet from his apartment door to Maria's apartment door. Ultimately, we had actually knocked on his door like three times and left a business card. And I had made a note, knocked on the door of apartment so-and-so, he's not here. And we simply never were contacted by him and never contacted him.
Once you had a name, how did you connect Michael Gargiulo as a potential suspect in Maria Bruno's murder?
When Rich notified me about the DNA coming back on the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy, and that it belonged to Mr. Gargiulo, and that Gargiulo used to live in El Monte at the Maria Bruno murder scene, Rich had given me a bit of background about him. And included amongst that background was the fact that his DNA had been entered into the CODIS DNA database by the Cook County, Illinois Sheriff's Police. And that's a term that they used back there, Sheriff's Police, for the investigative arm of the Cook County Sheriff's Department. That said, Rich knew that Gargiulo was a potential suspect in an August 1993 murder that had occurred in unincorporated Cook County, Illinois. And so he had actually been in contact with the unsolved cold case homicide detective from Cook County, Illinois Sheriff's named Lou Sala. And so Rich had provided me with that information when he had given me the identification of Gargiulo. So one of the first things that I did was actually communicate with Lou Sala, Cook County, Illinois Sheriff's, and we kind of compared notes. And it was pretty obvious pretty quickly that, we had what appeared on the surface of being very similar murders in MO and in victimology and location and the type of attack. And there were just untold numbers of similarities between the two murders, between the Cook County, Illinois murder and the El Monte, California murder. So looped into that conversation was Detective Tom Small, who was an LAPD homicide detective that I did not know, but wound up meeting and becoming very friendly with. And Tom had the then unsolved murder of a young woman named Ashley Ellerant, And Tom's murder occurred, I believe, in February of 2001. So myself, Lou Sala from Cook County, Illinois Sheriffs, Tommy Small from LAPD Hollywood Division, and Rich Lewis from Santa Monica, California Police Department, we were all able to kind of communicate with each other, which was great. Quite often, especially like TV and movies and books, you know, you see cops not getting along or cops, you know, hogging information or they don't want to share, and nothing could be really further from the truth. That may be true of their idiot bosses, but in real life, cops are more than happy to share with each other. That being said, the four of us all got along very, very well. We're able to share information and really pretty quickly come up with you know, identification that, hey, we're all looking at the same, very much a similar, the same MO and the same type of suspect in all four of our separate incidents. Three of them being murders, one of them being an attempt murder. So that's kind of how all of that came together. And again, I'd love to flex my big muscles and take credit for it. And sadly, the truth is, I was nothing but a lucky hanger-on. I had nothing to do with that coordination. It was all you know, Rich and Tom and Lou. So that's where that's at.
You then searched Gargiulo's apartment, which he had since moved out of. What did you find of interest?
After my partner and I, Joe Purcell, had been advised that Gargiulo was potentially, you know, a suspect in the El Monte murder of Maria Bruno, we wound up looking at things in a different light because now we're armed with information and identification of a potential suspect. So we wound up going back to the murder scene months after it had occurred, actually years after it occurred, and speaking with the apartment building management. It turned out that the Gargiulo apartment had been rented, abandoned. There had been three or four other renters that had moved into and moved out of the apartment since the time that Mike Gargiulo had abandoned the apartment and moved on. So we wanted to take a look at it, and it happened to be empty. So that worked out perfect. So the management allowed us to go into that apartment, and it was like many of the apartments in the building. It was freshly painted. It had new carpet. It was really, really a immaculately cleaned apartment. And I will always remember the day because it was hotter than heck out, as it gets here in Southern California, in Los Angeles. And of course, wearing suits and ties. And I remember at one point in time, we're standing in the apartment and there was an attic, which is pretty unusual for an apartment building here in Southern California, especially one that's not all that old, that was built like in the 70s or 80s. And this is a two-story apartment building, but the apartment itself had an attic, which was, it was pretty rare. So Joe and I are both looking at the attic door. And again, I'd like to take credit, and I can't. Joe's a little bit older and just a little bit bigger than me. And the younger, skinnier guy has to go up on a ladder into the attic, which I did not want to do with my suit and tie. So Joe convinced me it was the right thing to do. And lo and behold, we got a ladder from the maintenance people and crawled up in the attic, which I thought was going to be a complete and total and utter waste of time. And there, just inside the opening to the attic, was a plastic bag. And then next to that bag was a couple of other items. And inside the plastic bag was a number of things, including a Christmas card addressed to Mike Gargiulo. Gee, that's interesting. And also inside the plastic bag was a matching blue cotton tissue bootie, exactly the same make and model and manufacturer as the one that we had found at the crime scene with the blood of victim Maria Bruno on it. Also inside that bag, I believe, was a embroidered towel, and it had a bunch of Korean language and design on it. And I ultimately learned, because I didn't know then, it is not uncommon in the Korean culture to actually embroider almost like an obituary or a memorial to a loved one who's passed on in that form on a towel or a blanket. And this towel was actually that. It was like a memorial to a deceased loved one from the Korean culture. Well, when Mike Gargiulo lived in the apartment building during the time of the murder of Maria Bruno, he lived with a very nice woman whose name was Grace Kwok. And Grace was a first generation Korean American and came from a very large, loving Korean family. and the towel that we found in the bag, along with the booty, along with the Christmas card addressed to Mike Gargiulo, belonged to Grace Kwok. And it was pretty easy to make the assumption that at some point in time, Mike Gargiulo had placed the towel, the bag, the card, and the blue matching booty to the booty recovered at the murder scene up there in the attic, and had quite frankly forgotten about it when he moved months later. And so it was really a stroke of luck that we were able to recover that. That particular booty, I, off the top of my head, I don't recall that we actually obtained any DNA off of that booty, but circumstantially, that evidence was really powerful to compare that item, the booty found in the attic, to the same booty that was found at the crime scene. Unlike our poor friends at LAPD and the O.J. Simpson case, who had issues with gloves of a similar nature, we got lucky, and you know, maybe we learned from that prior incident, and we didn't have the issues they had in getting it admitted and getting the jury to understand the significance of that evidence and the power behind it and what it meant.
Was there any evidence that Gargiulo had worn either of the medical booties?
Yeah, there. I mean, the crime scene, like I said earlier, it was really pristine. It was clean. This apartment had been repainted and recarpeted, and it was clean. And this woman, Maria, had only lived in the apartment for 10 days prior to having gotten killed inside of it. So sadly, we did not recover any fingerprints. We did not recover any DNA from the actual apartment itself or the crime scene itself. We didn't recover any DNA or hairs or fibers from Maria's body that were instrumental in leading to the identification of the actual suspect. The one critical piece was the blue medical cloth booty that was recovered about 10 feet outside of the front door of the apartment. That ultimately was determined to have several drops of blood on it, and they were Maria's blood. And later, quite a bit later in the investigation, we were able to get a DNA profile from the elastic band around the opening of this booty. And that DNA ultimately was determined to have come from Gargiulo or a very close male relative of Gargiulo's. The numbers weren't so definitive as to rule out, you know, Gargiulo to the exclusion of everybody else on Earth, but pretty close. It's like it was either Gargiulo or his dad or his brother. The numbers were kind of in that range without going scientifically crazy on you. And we were clearly able to prove that it was Gargiulo because we eliminated, I mean, his dad was a 90-year-old man living in a rest home in Illinois, and his brother, you know, was a guy that, you know, we were able to exclude him as being the contributor to the DNA on this booty. And, you know, it was able to, again, to draw a conclusion by excluding other people. So that was really the only DNA that was available, you know, in this particular murder case. And it's kind of ironic, I guess is the best word for it, because it's ironic in the sense that here the suspect, the serial killer, Mike Gargiulo, took extraordinary effort to protect himself from being identified. And the very item that he used to act as a prophylactic in that manner is what helped convict him and send him to death row. I mean, I think it's ironic. I don't know if your listeners will, but it kind of makes me chuckle a little bit.
In September of 2008, armed with the DNA evidence in Maria Bruno and Trisha Picaccio's case, plus the attack on Michelle Murphy, Lilienfeld and LAPD Detective Tom Small filed charges against Gargiulo with the L.A. District Attorney's Office for the murders of Ashley Elrin and Maria Bruno. While no DNA evidence was found at the scene of Ashley Elrin's murder, the circumstantial evidence was mounting against Gargiulo, given his proximity to each murder, as well as the way they were attacked. Mark Lilienfeld, were detectives able to interview Gargiulo after he was arrested?
At some point in time, relatively briefly after Gargiulo was arrested by the Santa Monica Police Department and charged with the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy in Santa Monica, I had an opportunity to meet with him and to attempt to interview him. He was somewhat polite. He listened to the introduction my partner and I kind of had with him. We tried to, as we always do, somewhat, you know, treat him with respect and dignity and kind of, you know, be humane about it. But we really wanted to talk to the guy and hear his side of the story. Of course, he had a series of constitutional rights that we had to advise him of. And he chose to invoke his right not only to remain silent, but to not speak without an attorney present. That said, it was a very brief interaction that we had with him, maybe like 10 or 15 minutes at the most. He really didn't want to talk about anything. I mean, he was pretty turned off to us. I believe we interviewed him, my partner and I from Los Angeles County Sheriff Joe Purcell, we interviewed him. I believe we were second in line, and he had already been interviewed and already invoked with the Santa Monica Police Department a day or two earlier regarding that offense. So it wasn't a surprise that he invoked his right to remain silent and chose not to speak with us. That being said, at some point in time after that, the environment was created where Mr. Gargiulo wound up having a series of very long conversations that were captured electronically. And in them, he alluded repeatedly to not only the murder of Maria Bruno, but to the murders both in Chicago and the murder of Ashley Ellerin being investigated by Tom Small that occurred in LAPD Hollywood Division's area. So that audio that was captured while he was in custody talking about those things, all of that was admissible. There is a great deal of law regarding, you know, statements and evidence and when they're admissible and when they're not. And it's very nuanced. There's a lot to it. But we were able to, you know, obtain that lawfully. And ultimately, the statements were used in trial against Mr. Gargiulo. In the statements, one could assume from the statements that were obtained from Mr. Gargiulo that in fact he was possibly responsible for 10 murders, in addition to the three murders I previously spoke of, that being Ashley Ellerin, Maria Bruno, and then of course Tricia Picascio in Cook County, Illinois. He basically alluded that he was responsible for another 7. So to this day, and it's one of the reasons I'm even speaking on this program, to this day we've never really been able to identify or locate those other 7 murders. Mr. Gargiulo was born and raised in Glenview, Illinois. When he was about 18, he traveled across the country to Los Angeles, California. He made a number of trips back and forth across the country, that 2,000 miles, both by car, by air, by bus, by train. We really don't know. Those records don't exist anymore. But, you know, if one of your listeners or anybody out there has any kind of a connection to or any information about potentially the murder of a young, attractive female who most likely was murdered in what appeared to be a frenzied attack, and the weapon was a knife or some kind of sharp force injury, certainly Los Angeles Sheriff's, Los Angeles PD, Cook County, Illinois Sheriff's, Santa Monica Police Department, they'd all be interested in knowing the details about that and perhaps eliminating Mr. Gargiulo as a suspect in it. But I and the other detectives, I think we're all in agreement that potentially those statements obtained from Mr. Gargiulo are legitimate and real. And for all we know, there's some poor family in Omaha, Nebraska, or, you know, Lubbock, Texas, or Peoria, Illinois, that lost a loved one in the manner in which I'm describing. And we just haven't been able to identify or tie him into that murder.
Gargiulo's recorded interactions were part of a Perkins operation. Two undercover detectives were placed in Gargiulo's jail cell while he was being held in a El Monte Police Department jail. Let's bring back Joshua Ritter, criminal defense attorney, former LA County Deputy District Attorney. Josh, can you explain how a Perkins operation works and how the information obtained from it would be admissible in court?
A Perkins operation is a very valuable tool for law enforcement because it takes advantage of when a suspect in custody is most likely to want to start sharing information, but they don't want to share that information directly with law enforcement. And this is a bit of subterfuge or trickery, however you want to classify it, used by law enforcement, where they will essentially put an undercover officer in the same holding cell as a usually recently arrested suspect, to just kind of chat with him casually. And it's amazing how many times these officers don't even have to bring up what it is that's going on, what the person is in for. People just, when first arrested, can't help themselves oftentimes from sharing information. And that's exactly what happened in this case. The detectives, being very savvy, put Gargiulo in a holding cell, while at the same time they were bringing him in and out of the cell to interrogate him. So they would bring him out, talk to him a little bit about what he was under arrest for, and then also ask him some questions about other crimes, other murders, and then put him back into the holding cell. And when he was with the officers, he didn't have much information to share and mainly said he doesn't know what they're talking about. But then when he got back into the holding cell, he couldn't help but share some of that information with his cell partners, who he believed to be also recent arrestees, but were in fact undercover officers. And during the course of that, they learned some very valuable information. Though it didn't come down to what I would call a full-on confession, it was close enough for it to be very valuable, up until the point of Gargiulo almost demonstrating how he had stabbed one of these victims, because he was trying to play out in his mind the stab wounds and the pattern and how, you know, whether or not it was a left-handed or right-handed person. And in doing so, wanted to demonstrate with one of his cellmates that gave them very valuable information. So Perkins operations are employed by law enforcement. They're done sparingly because it is a dangerous situation. You're putting an officer in the same cell as someone who has committed murder. You're asking an officer to put themselves at risk to some extent. And you have to conduct them very carefully to make sure that it's not coercive, that you're not violating any kind of constitutional protections that the suspect may have, because you may get incredibly valuable information, but if you run afoul of their constitutional rights, all of that may be thrown out. So they're conducted in a very careful manner to make sure that that evidence is preserved and available to the prosecutors at trial.
3 years later, in June 2011, CBS 48 Hours aired a story about Gargiulo titled "The Boy Next Door." Let's bring in Maureen Maher, former correspondent for 48 Hours. Maureen, tell us about the special and how it came together.
Late summer 2008, we got a call from one of the jurisdictions in California who had worked with our investigative producer, Doug Longini, on a previous case. And they asked us if we could go and speak with the Picaccios, because they were having a really hard time connecting with the Picaccios through Cook County. And because myself and this producer, Doug Longini, we both live close to the Picaccios, it was easy for us to go in and start talking to them and create a relationship where every couple of months we would go talk to them. But I'll be honest with you, after the very first time we met them, we both walked out and said, there's no way those two people can ever get on television. They're so heartbroken. It's like it happened yesterday. And I had just not witnessed that kind of palpable pain and suffering, except when you met up with family members in the first few days or weeks, or in the middle of the court when it was all brought up again. But this was years, decades later, and it was still so raw for the Picaccios. It took us another 2.5 years of talking to them and convincing them that by going public with us, maybe we could get more information that Cook County just had not been able to put their hands on. And if they would cooperate with LA area officers to give any information they could about the circumstances surrounding Trisha's death and why they thought Gargiulo might be involved. There just wasn't enough information in Ashley's case at the time, and they needed more. And California has that law that says prior bad acts can be included. And I think they were hoping that the case of Trisha's murder might help out the other cases and solidify evidence. I mean, he was arrested, he was charged, and he was in county jail in LA, but they didn't have a lot, at least in Ashley's case at that time.
What can you tell us about your interaction with the Picaccio family over the years?
You know, our what came out, at least in the first meeting with them, and then every other meeting, with every meeting since then. I saw the Picaccios not too long ago. I still see them on a fairly regular basis. From the very first time we met with them and every subsequent meeting, there is so much heartbreak and pain and anger and frustration over how long it is taking for this case to go to court, how long it took to get charges filed against Michael Gargiulo, how long it took to get people to listen to them, how long it's taken now to get through the trials in California. Every single meeting I've ever had with them, in person or on the phone, it isn't just the pain and suffering of the parents of a murdered child. It is the anger and the frustration that they have had to wait so long for movement in their case. And the pain was so real. And you've seen in the 48 hours piece, I believe that Diane said that at one point in the early 2000s, she was still going in to see investigators every week to remind them, we're still here, but Trisha's not. And that at one point someone said to her, one of the investigators, there's something wrong with you and you need to seek help. I just can't imagine, you're going through the loss of your child. You found your child in this horrible state, and you're now being told by the people who are tasked with helping you find justice that we're just not sure this case will ever be solved and you should probably seek additional counseling. So that's something that comes up every single time I speak with her. It is still very real for her 30 years later.
What happened after the special aired?
So the piece finally airs. I mean, it wasn't just Cook County that was reluctant to work with us. We had a hard time getting our senior staff on board with this case because there was no clear outcome for it there. They didn't know if there were ever going to be charges in the Trisha Picaccio case, and we didn't know when he would go to court in California on the three cases there. So we all had, this was a case that took a Herculean effort on every possible level to get it moving forward. So it finally airs 3 years, almost 3 years after we first met the Picaccios, and we pitched, Doug and I pitched the story to our senior staff at 48 Hours. It airs in May of 2011, and 1 minute after the show ended, I got an email from AOL Patch, which I had done an interview with earlier in the week, that there was somebody who had responded and said, hey, we're going to forward you a viewer comment, a reader comment, and we think it's important, but we're handing it off to you. And it was from a gentleman who said that he had pertinent information that Gargiulo had confessed to him, and he couldn't get anyone in Cook County or anywhere else to listen. And he seemed grief-stricken through the email that he and I then started emailing back and forth later that evening, that he didn't realize there were these other cases hanging out there. So I got on the phone with Timur Leary the next morning We had a long conversation about how we knew Michael, when he'd first heard what Michael had said to him, when he first heard it, who he had told, who else was in the car with him, and that was Anthony DiLorenzo, and how many times Gargiulo had said something to this effect to him. I hung up the phone, called my producer, Doug, and I said, so I know what we normally would do would be to jump up and down and say, hey, we got to get this guy on TV. But because we knew how long the Picaccios had waited, the two of us decided that journalistically, ethically, the right thing to do was to go to a source that Doug had within Cook County Sheriff's Department and say, we want to connect you with somebody. We'll do our interview, but it's important that you know this person is out there. And also, we want to know, did you know this person was out there? So immediately we put Teamer in connection with Cook County Sheriff's Department, which is different than the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. These are two separate entities. And our connection and our belief that Cook County Sheriff's Department would do something with the information, we felt better about going to them. And then they brought Teamer, and I don't know when Anthony came in, but I know Teamer was brought into Chicago within a few days and then sat down with investigators, and eventually a grand jury was brought in. And maybe it was 6 weeks later that the charges were filed.
On July 7th, 2011, then Cook County State Attorney Anita Alvarez announced the new evidence that emerged after the 48-hour episode, coupled with the DNA, gave them sufficient evidence to finally charge Michael Gargiulo with Tricia Picaccio's murder. This is almost 20 years since Tricia Picaccio was killed in 1993, and 7 years since Cook County decided not to prosecute him with the DNA evidence in 2003. In the U.S., there is no statute of limitations on murder. So if someone kills someone and 30 years go by, someone can still be charged with the crime. Tricia Picaccio's family waited almost 20 years for Michael Gargiulo to be charged with the crime. Can you imagine being a family and not knowing for almost 20 years who did this to your own child? But now they would potentially get some sense of justice. In our final two episodes, we revisit the trial of the murder of Ashley Elrin, Maria Bruno, and the attempted murder of Michelle Murphy, where Michael Gargiulo would face a possible death penalty and finally come face to face with the victims' families. I'm Kelly Hyman, and this is Once Upon a Crime in Hollywood, The Hollywood Ripper.